All right, welcome in, everybody. Dave Plyer here on 720 WGN. Glad you could be with us. You know, it is Father's Day weekend. We'll call it an annual Father's Day show. My oldest son, Josh, joining me in studio. Hey, buddy.
Hello, everyone.
Used to do my overnight show with me on Father's Day weekend. It's been a few years, and maybe even before COVID, that we've done this for a long time.
Yeah, it's been some time. School is definitely a little bit heavier, but now that that's at a tail end here.
I think the last time you were in studio was kind of impromptu. It was on Lisa Dent's show.
Correct.
Which was doing Crosstalk.
No.
And she was lamenting about your porn mustache.
Yes, thank you.
That you've grown over the years. So no stranger to being on the show. He's also got, Josh also has a 17-year-old sister, almost 11-year-old brother. But Josh is with me here in studio today. So I'm the proud dad, so I have to mention this, that Josh just graduated from the School of the Art Institute a few weeks ago.
Thank you very much.
Congratulations.
Thank
We're going to be celebrating next week. And so I'm actually not going to be here next week. And, you know, you got to work in the city that, you know, he's studying architecture. So, you know, you got to work and play and study in the city that is so well known for architecture. Mm-hmm. And I remember on the college hunt years ago, every school we talked to in the Midwest was, we're going to spend a lot of time in Chicago.
Right.
We heard that over and over.
We're doing a weekend in Chicago. We're going to be studying a lot of Chicago. It's like, well, why do I leave?
Yeah, why do you? Yeah, do it right here, right? Do it right here. Well, congratulations to you, buddy. Very
Thank
proud
you.
Of you. All right, let's talk a little bit about what's on the show. So Josh and I have some things we're going to share after the break, but comedian Jimmy Crane is performing his one-man show for Father's Day with two shows tomorrow called World's Best Father. I think the 7 o'clock show sold out, 9 o'clock show still happening in Glenview, and he'll join Josh and I in studio to talk about his journey in fatherhood, his relationship with his dad. It's a fascinating story, and we'll do that. The 55th Annual Summerfest, the world's largest music festival, starts up in Milwaukee next week. And I'm going to tell you, that is something we've done over and over the years.
But there are definitely some artists that I'm excited to see. So I look forward to coming up in the next couple weeks.
But we don't care about, like, after dinner, you know, all of a sudden saying, hey, let's go to Milwaukee and go listen to some music.
Yeah, it's close enough that we can do that, and definitely worth the trip every time.
You know, with the Kennedy being a mess and the roads closing due to NASCAR it's going to be easier to get to Milwaukee than Chicago.
Right.
I'm just telling you, it's going to be quicker and easier. I think last time we went, it was 2019.
Last time we all went together was for Billie Eilish.
Oh,
that
Billie
was
Eilish.
When we all went together.
Which was my favorite.
Right.
Of course.
It was your idea.
But Tom Petty, we've seen that. We've seen a ton of artists there, and it is so much fun. And you think about all the bands, all the stages, all the different types of genres of music. We're going to welcome in Scott Zeal. He's the VP of Entertainment. He's the guy, toughest job on the planet. He's got to listen to good music and book great bands.
Sounds awful.
Sounds awful for this event. And then watching TV author and Professor Wally Podrazik will join us to break down TV's top dads. I love doing that. And we want, of course, hear from you as well. 312-981-7200. Call, text, whatever you feel comfortable with. Now, top TV dads. Now, I come from a little bit more of a TV generation. So, like, I grew up with a lot of classic shows, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. Like, if you were going to say, like, a contemporary dad that you thought was funny,
I would have to say Phil Dunphy was definitely a pretty good dad.
Modern Family.
In my eyes, yeah.
Modern Family.
For sure.
I would say Howard Cunningham from Happy Days, because that's something I grew up with. Oh, I would have to say, who else? Tony Soprano was a great dad.
I mean, right.
He did. He cared about his family.
And yeah, he supported them through hard times, if you can consider that. But, like, now that I'm thinking about it, if we go back to Modern Family, Al Bundy was a father in two different shows.
Yeah, he was.
Because he was a father in Modern Family and in
Married with Children. I would say he wasn't a great dad, Married with Children.
No. But he's a funny one.
He was a funny dad, for sure. So we'll talk about that sometime later in the show. So Josh and I will kick off this show right after this here on 720 WGN. All right, it's Father's Day weekend. It's Dave and Josh Plyer. Hey, buddy.
Hello, how are you?
I am good. Back in studio. So I found this article on father-son bonding. And you know what? We naturally, over the years, and myself, all my kids, have a great relationship, and we do have our bonding moments and one-on-one time with one another. And Josh and I hang out, and I have daddy-daughter dates with my daughter, and Alex and I hang out. So, you know, we get all our time together. But I thought this article was kind of funny because it's almost like forcing.
It's too perfect. I don't think many of these things. I think some of them definitely play true, but I think other things are a little
It seems
silly,
pretty forced, so, yes, a little forced, yes. But I thought we'd go through the list and just see how it applies to us.
Sure.
Okay, all right. Number one, because this is really good father-son bonding stuff.
Of course.
Take a selfie.
Yeah, don't call it that.
I know, you always say that
That's
to me.
That, like, no, outdated term. If you want to see us taking a selfie, you just check out his Facebook page.
But now, why not a selfie? Why can't you say
no,
selfie?
No, just don't. No, we're taking a picture. I can hold it facing me. Just don't get rid of the term.
All right. Play with Legos with no instructions. See, I could do that because I don't like following instructions. You are the master Lego builder.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's kind of my creative background. I can do that with ease. I'm not sure how long you'd be able to do it for. But I think if you got a plan in your head.
I did smaller stuff with you when you were younger. I did some with Emma. I did the smaller stuff. But when you're talking...
When the bags and boxes were 50 to 100 pieces,
yes.
Yeah, that was easy. And then we got into the couple of thousands, and we're doing the typewriter. I'm helping my little brother with some of his Legos. The typewriter, the Nintendo console.
The Home Alone house.
Oh, and the Home Alone
house.
How
big is that?
How many pieces? I don't know off the top of my head. I know that we also got like a lighting kit included, so it's going to be pretty schmancy. Yeah, not too sure.
Okay, the house is 4,000 pieces.
Right.
See, that's daunting to me just to even think about that.
I mean, they come in bags.
Like,
bags
I create, I can draw, but to physically do that, that is your thing, and that's your talent. And I think that, I honestly think that Legos over the years kind of drew you into this whole world of architecture.
Sure.
And drawing buildings and stuff and building
things. That and patience.
I think
sure.
So too. Oh yeah. I don't. Yeah. You've got your patience from someone else. Introduce your son to real comedy. So it says, show your boys what real cartoons should look like. Watching classic Bugs Bunny, which we do.
That is, I think if anyone's seen more Saturday morning cartoons and all of that stuff, it'd be me.
When there weren't Saturday morning cartoons.
Correct.
I kind of just invented it for you. But I think that's where I formed my own sense of humor.
Sure.
Was probably some of that stuff. It also mentions the Three Stooges, which
of
you've watched.
Yes.
But real comedy to me. And I should one day introduce you to like the Don Rickles and the Rodney Dangerfield.
Oh, one day? One day, sure. Why don't you give me a day where you find something that I haven't seen before, yeah. And then I'll be interested.
Yeah, the Rickles stuff, you and I have watched so many
times.
The
Rickles stuff, the Carson stuff. Definitely one who I think I've been most interested in as of recent would be George Carlin.
And Josh is 22, by the way, so
correct.
Just put that in perspective a little bit. But yeah, Flying on the Airlines was a classic.
The seatbelt.
I have so many tapes and albums of Carlin that we should. Mm-hmm. I know you can watch them on YouTube.
Sure.
Too. But watching some of that classic comedy stuff, mm-hmm. I think. There's nobody like these guys on the planet anymore, you know? Build something out of wood.
I could. I surely have whole semester. I took a couple of design courses. I built, and in a span of about 3 weeks, designed a paper model, built a chair, a side table, and an ottoman. That was a little adventurous to go for that far and that many things in a short period of time, but there was that. Bit of a record council thing I did, so I'm comfortable with woodworking and doing that sort of thing.
You and I built stuff for the house, certainly, and that does create some bonding. So when they're talking about father-son things, I guess that makes sense.
Sure. I don't think they're talking about IKEA, though. I think they're talking more of getting in a wood shop.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Let's see here. Mastering the grill. I think we do that.
That's fair.
Yeah,
we do plenty of grilling over the summer.
Yeah.
I'm more of the grill master cleaner and kind of keeping that thing in order.
Yeah, I did it this year.
Right.
I did. Visit an art museum, which we do.
Yeah.
And we've been at the Art Institute, obviously, where you go to school.
I've done that plenty as far as the past 4 years. But no, we've hit some museums in the past. Haven't been back to one as of recent, but definitely a few in the future.
Share the skill of sandcastle architecture. Now, I will say,
no,
that was always your thing, though, like building.
Well, of course. I mean, you're in a beach. You've got building material laying all over you. The first intuition of any guy, if it's a guy's trip, if it's guys and girls, they will just go to the sand and they'll start digging a big hole and doing something with it. So that is definitely something that I at least do.
Binge a TV show together, whether it's a new series or classic one. Exploring something newer from the past will sure to be a good time. I should try that.
Right. Yeah. Plenty of TV. I think the last TV shows that we at least binged would have been either Sopranos or Mad Men a little bit.
Remember over the summers, maybe it was summers when we knew there was a rainy day or something like that. We would binge later at night before bedtime. When you were much younger, we would pick a show every summer for years. And it was either the Brady Bunch, Happy Days, it was Laverne and Shirley,
Genie. It was Bewitched.
Yeah.
It was all of those.
Yeah, so if you ask any of my kids, anybody, my 11-year-old, they'd be referring to stuff that'd be like, yeah, you know, I just watched an episode of it. And their friends would be like, what?
What's
what are you talking about? A Match Game. That's another one from the 70s.
Well, Match Game, and then we also would be playing our own games of Password.
Yeah, but Match Game, and this is the funny thing, folks, like the old 70s Match Game, if you watch those, what we've realized is when we're trying to match, like when we take road trips, we'll throw it on, and you have to guess the answer based on the era. So it aired
on the era and based on the most popular answer you think, not
from the 70s.
Correct.
Like one of the words was Blank Taylor, and... You know, Evan just said Taylor Swift, and Taylor Swift didn't exist in the 70s. It would have been Elizabeth Taylor or whoever, you know, whoever would have been. Yeah, exactly. Lord and Taylor. Very good. Look at you thinking about that. Okay. Cliff dive.
I would. Would you?
It says also off the side of a pool. I'll do that.
Sure.
That's what it says.
Not quite.
I could.
Cliff, but...
I would do that. Share your favorite childhood book. I don't think I've done that, but there's a book that I've always loved about from that general about making your bed in the morning and how important that is to start your day. So I've given that to all my kids. Hit up a local skateboard park. I probably won't do that.
No.
Become a cookie master. We do cook. We do bake. We do bake in the house.
I could work.
And folks, these are things that to do with your kids. Dads to do with your sons. It's actually dad more to do with your sons or your daughters.
Right.
Show your child how to respect others. I think I've done pretty well in that category.
I've done that plenty.
Yeah. Walk the dog together. I think, here's the thing. We've just, you know, we have a puppy that's a couple years old, but we all have our separate time with the puppy.
Right.
You know, like, you know, you take it for walks, sleeps with you, you know, plays in the backyard, whatever it might be. You know, Emma does the same thing, Alex too. Spend some time outdoors. We do go on the boat quite a bit, and that is probably our big outdoors thing.
We have
a boat that we hang out, and that's kind of summer to my family. Go to a water park or a city pool. Done that. Let's see. Share favorite movies with one another. We've totally done that
for sure. We've even done like
age
movies outside. Definitely need to hit the drive-in sometime this summer again,
because
we did that last year, and definitely need to head back. That because I really haven't been back to the movies.
Indiana Jones, we should see at the drive-in.
Ooh, sure.
Yeah. Get a haircut together.
No comment.
I'm
I'll get a haircut. I'm not
bald.
Sure what you're going to get cut.
Yeah, but. I mean, I could get a clean shave on my head.
Eyebrows or something.
Eyebrows. Take him to a concert. Definitely have done that.
Well, that's a good segue.
Billie Eilish we talked about. That was probably the last one we did as as a group with Emma. But we also did the first concert. Do you remember the first concert I took you to?
We did the Monkees.
The Monkees with Davey. Davey was still around at that time. But yeah, we went to see the Monkees. Find the coolest playground. Now, more up in Wisconsin, we look at the playgrounds that still have those like spinning like merry-go-round things that you jump on.
Of course.
The ones that are not allowed in Illinois anymore.
No.
That I like seeking out. Go to the library together.
That's not for me
either. Teach them how to shuffle cards.
Honestly, I've been quite the dealer myself. I kind of found myself in a niche of like collecting cards, vintage playing cards, and all those types of things. So. Gosh, playing like Castle and Gin Rummy and Go Fish with some people. That's been fun.
But a younger generation, I'm talking to you folks out there that like have young kids or grandchildren, like anything that is not electronic, you know, most kids have not experienced. And I would say the first thing that happens to us when we go to a restaurant, no matter where it is your sister will say, who's got the cards?
Who's got the cards, right.
Who's got the cards? I mean,
it's one thing that'll take you off a screen. You can all kind of participate and have fun. So that's definitely been something.
Board games, too.
Right.
We do a lot of board games.
Big Monopoly.
Yeah, we've got about, there's a cough button.
I hit it.
We have 30 Monopoly games, different right. versions. Might be one coming for Father's Day. I heard a rumor.
Well, based on the delivery time, might be your birthday. So.
Well, I found a Curb Your Enthusiasm Monopoly game, but we do play a lot of board games. And I think that's fascinating to a lot of friends of yours and your sister and your brother that come over, that we're going to sit down at a table and open up a board game. But there's a great interaction there, mm-hmm. you know, I think through some of that. So here's the last one. If old enough, go out and have a drink together. So if that's not a problem for some people, that could be a lot of fun. And there was a time, I think more through NFL season, that you and I, on a Thursday night, that if you weren't working, I wasn't working, you and mm-hmm. I would go and watch a game and have a couple drinks, whether right. it's a couple beers, a couple old fashions, whatever it'll be. And that's a really different time for a parent or a grandparent to go have a drink with your kids. Mm-hmm. So again, if it's something you can do. And there was also a time that you and I took out Grandpa, my dad. And, you know, Gibson's is by his house. He loves that place. So we took him to dinner and he called and said he was on his way. And we asked him what he wanted to drink and ordered his drink and some appetizers for the table. So he walked up to the table and I said, here's your vodka gimlet. Mm-hmm. Here's some appetizers. Here's some fresh bread. And I saw this woman coming up behind me. Do you remember this? And I said, and here's your date tonight. And I had no idea who this woman was. And she went up to my dad, shook her hand.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, how are you? Where do you want me to sit? And my father looked at me like, wait a minute, what?
No.
She was very sweet, hugged my dad, told us boys to have a nice evening. Mm. But it's nice to have generations of family members go out, especially for Father's Day weekend. So think about what you'd want to do with your dad, your grandpa, if they're still around, a close father figure, someone you look up to. And spend some time with them this weekend, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
All right, we got a big show coming up. Comedian Jimmy Corrine will join us in studio after the news next here on 720 WGN. All right, Dave and Josh Pleyer with you here on this Father's Day weekend here on 720 WGN. So Father's Day, you know, let's celebrate the joys and pitfalls of being a father and having a father with Jimmy Corrine's hit one-person show, World's Greatest Dad, and that's with a question mark, and that's playing at the Laughing Academy in Glenview Saturday at 7 for a sold-out show. 9 o'clock is still available for tickets. So in the show, Jimmy talks about starting out in improv in the 90s with famous people like Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, Rachel Dratch, Tim Meadows, Andy Dick. And then 10 years into therapy, Jimmy, depressed about his career, his therapist suggests that Jimmy and his wife have a baby to bring more joy into their life, which launches him on a journey of fertility treatments and a quest to become a dad at the age of 52. He also talks about his complicated relationship with his own dad, workaholic, real estate developer, some embezzlement, and some federal prison sprinkled in there. But through it all, Jimmy takes you on this funny and poignant roller coaster of life and death and shares his discovery that you don't have to be the greatest dad to be a good dad. And comedian Jimmy Corrine joins us in studio. Jimmy, how are you, bud?
Oh, I'm doing good. Thanks, Dave. And thanks for bringing Josh along.
Absolutely. Well, I thought he'd have some insight on one of the world's greatest dads,
yes,
you know?
This is like...
when I meet him, I'll let you know.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Wow, right, wow. Yeah. Well, you know, it's going to be a long car ride home for you, Josh.
Yeah, it is.
Your dad and I might not be talking
or
to
train
you.
Train ride.
Right, yeah. I was going to say it's going to be a train ride for him.
Oh,
yeah.
Or a train wreck.
But speaking of which, like, everyone has different relationships with their parents, and those family relationships are a roller coaster, right?
Yeah. So my relationship with my dad was very complicated, and he wasn't home a lot because, you know, that was that generation. They were working all the time. And then in college, he started to do these bogus real estate deals where he would, you know, it was a genius. You know, he'd say, I'm going to buy a building. He'd take all your money and wouldn't buy the building. And the government was clear that it was a crime. So he was sent away to federal prison for 33 years. I don't want to, no, it wasn't that. It was only 33 months. I don't want to make him out to be, you know, okay. something worse right. than
yeah,
he was.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
So that complicated my relationship with my father.
Well, you know, we always talk about there's got to be some tragedy in life to get to the comedy aspect of things, right?
Yeah. So my form, you know, it's comedy plus tragedy. I mean, comedy plus time equals tragedy. Mine is comedy plus therapy plus time equals comedy.
Okay. All right. That's fair. Well, comedy, it's in your blood. So like, you know, I was in countless audiences in Second City in the 90s when you were on stage and Tina Fey and Rachel Dratch and Scott Adsit at Second City. This was a golden time, and it was all over Chicago,
right?
Wasn't
and
it?
We're never going to see that again. And so I was at the Annoyance Theater. There was Andy Richter. There was Melanie Hutzel, Beth Cahill. They had all gone on. We had also the Real Life Brady Bunch. So the Soloways, who had did the show A Transparent.
Alice was great, by the way.
Yes, Mary Weiss was her name.
Mary Weiss, yeah.
Then. When I was at the Improv Olympic, I'm in classes with Chris Farley. Mike Myers is sitting in on our team at the Improv Olympic. Up on the main stage at Second City, you have Stephen Colbert, Stephen Carell. Then later, Amy Poehler, Tina Fey. I mean, it
Chicago.
All Chicago. Yeah. And not only that, you had Jon Favreau and Adam McKay, who are also in the improv community, who've gone on to do great things as film directors.
Yeah. That's amazing to me. But no, when you say all that, though, like even if you look at some of these people that you just mentioned, you knew there was tragedy in their life when they became a star, before they became a star. And I think I hate to say this, but like the more traumatic or the more things you experience as a child really develops into becoming a better comedian. I mean, who do you know that, you know, didn't go through something and they brought it out through comedy?
Right. And if they did, if they didn't, they're not very funny, in my opinion.
That's true.
I think for me, the more at the time, if it's embarrassing, if it's painful, if you're feeling shame, at the time, it's really hard. But then later, you're thinking, you go back when you have perspective, because you have to have some objectivity to it. You go, okay, this is going to be a great story. And that's what I put in this show. A lot of painful moments, which seem painful at the time, but have made, they're very funny, you know?
Yeah. And talking about it, and you mentioned therapy also, that kind of helps bring that stuff out too.
Yes, it definitely does.
Different perspectives.
Yeah, and the thing is, I think for me, my goal is when I go on stages, how can I make fun of myself? How can I tell on myself? If I'm a control freak, how can I make that funny for the audience? But also by telling that, I'm getting something out of it too.
That's very, very true. It is very focused on fatherhood and you as a father. But talk to us a little bit more in depth about this relationship with your dad, because we're around the same age, and this is, you know, a time when you were growing up where, you know, usually dads were at work, moms were at home, so you didn't see your dad a lot. He was involved in a lot of things, and that was your dad, too.
Right. So, so the other thing I want to say about my dad, and so he's been dead now for, I don't know, about 7 years, and I remember reading something, and it's so true. I feel closer to my dad now that he's dead than when he was alive. And doing this show, I started to see the good things that my dad gave me. My dad gave me a love of Chicago. He taught me good manners. He was very, very supportive of my comedy career, you know? And in the show, I there's one point where he asks me to speak at his funeral. And he says, because you made me laugh and no one made me laugh like you did.
Wow, wow. And I know, you know, by the time you got to that point, there was a little scuffle at the funeral, wasn't there?
Oh, yeah, there was a big scuffle.
Explain that a little bit.
My family didn't want me to speak, even though my dad had asked me. My family didn't want to speak. I'm a comedian. I'm going to get up there. I'm going to joke about prison or something. So,
oh, interesting.
So they didn't want me to speak at all. And so they did everything they could to stop me. And when I got to the church, the priest said, hey, there's been a last minute change. Now, and we'd all agreed I could speak at the mass. They said, there's been a last minute change. Nobody's going to speak. And so I decided I was going to get up on a pew before the funeral started. And then all of a sudden, my family surrounded me like a mob. And I don't know who, to this day, I still don't know. Someone pushed me off the pew. And then the next thing I know, the Winnetka police show up. And the priest was, I mean, it was a really chaotic. Yeah. And my friends are chanting, let him speak. Let him speak.
There are some churches, though, that want to eliminate some of that stuff, which I don't understand. Like at a funeral, they're like, you can speak for 1 minute. It can be this. Like, how do you do that to send somebody off? That drives me nuts.
So what's interesting when I do this piece, and I actually got to speak. So, but people will come up to me and say just what you said. Someone said the same thing happened at my dad's funeral. They told me I could only speak for a minute or only could speak for 3 minutes. And so I don't know what's going on, but it's Why is that a thing?
I don't know.
But if this was stand up, nobody would stand for 3 minutes. We'd need at least
18 minutes.
Five. I would take five.
Yeah, okay.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah. So this all happens, and you do get to speak.
Yes, I do.
Yeah. And how did people feel about what you said? Like, was it a good thing? Were they happy with what came out of all that?
I remember, because I had stayed up the night before writing it, and I was crying and stuff. And as a performer, I'm like, you know, I did better, you know, in front of the mirror at home. So I was a little
different audience.
It was a different audience, and I was a little disappointed in my performance. But I had a friend there because I was in shock. I mean, it was very traumatic, you know, being pushed off a pew and just the response from my family. Yeah. But I had a friend who said, you know, when you got off stage, it was the altar. I call it a stage. They said, you know, people were clapping.
Oh, great. Okay, so a good outcome.
Yeah.
In that, we're talking to comedian and improv extraordinaire Jimmy Crane. His one person show, World's Greatest Dad. That's with a question mark. Playing at the Laughing Academy in Glenview Saturday at 7 and 9. 7 sold out. Tickets still available for the 9 o'clock show. You can get them at laughingacademy.com. And there's more with them next here on 720 WGN.
It's Josh and Dave Plyer back with you on 720 WGN. And we are talking to comedian Jimmy Crane. His one-man show is World's Greatest Dad, playing at the Laughing Academy in Glenview on Saturday at 7 p.m. That is sold out, but there are still tickets for the 9 p.m. show. Tickets are at thelaughingacademy.com.
So we were talking a little bit about your dad, but you're a dad yourself, and you became a dad a little bit later in life.
Yeah, I was 52, basically because my therapist said I needed more joy in my life. I'd always been obsessed with fame. So I thought, well, you know, I've done everything my therapist has asked me up until this point, and it's like, okay, I've gotten this far. Maybe if I have a baby, I'll become famous. And that's really why I did it. And I got to tell you something, it was a lot harder than I thought having a child at my age.
Yeah, okay, all right. You know, I mean, Josh was asking me like how old I was when I had, because he's got a 17-year-old sister and 11-year-old brother. So I was a little older when I had my young one, but I feel like that just keeps me young, keeps me on my toes.
Yeah, it definitely does.
Yeah.
So I'm 52 now, my daughter's 7 years old now. And I got to tell you something, going down the first couple of years, going down on the floor was very easy. Now it's a little harder getting up, you know, and you don't have as much energy. And a lot of people are really kind. You know, I'm 52 and I thought, like, my God, you know, give me credit. You know, like, I'm amazing. I had this baby.
Tony Randall was like 84 when he had his first kid or last kid, wasn't he?
And Al Pacino.
Al Pacino now.
85. Uh-huh. Josh. See, now you're going to do.
And De Niro.
Yes. Right. And De Niro. Well, yes. Yeah. So I thought, like, give me credit. You know what people go? They go like, when are you going to have the next one?
Oh.
You know, you're like, geez.
Oh, man.
Let me get through this one. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So what did you learn, though, like, from either parenthood or from life experiences that has made you a good dad? You said not maybe world's greatest, but a good dad.
I think the one thing that my daughter's taught me is, like, people in comedy, you know, you were talking about, you know, like, they come from a bad childhood and stuff like that. But the other thing is, we're very serious people, you know, and more than we let on. So I'm not very playful in real life. I'm very serious. If something goes wrong, it's a disaster. We're, you know, I'm Eeyore. I'll never make it. But my daughter, when you have a kid, you know, and I learned this very quickly. And Josh, I hope you're listening. He's shaking his head the first 2 months, we were going out to the Jewel or something, and I had her in the car seat, and all of a sudden she starts crying. It's like, we're not going to go to the Jewel, and this is improv. Like, I could sit there and try to force it, or I could just roll with it. And that, accepting that, it was huge. And also, kids are amazing. Like, talk about being in the moment. The other day, again, a Jewel story, because I have food issues. We're in the Jewel, and she stops and she goes, "Oh, look at that sponge!" And she takes the sponge out and she wants to play it and stuff, like, play with it. And it's like, that's improv, you know?
Simplicity.
Yeah.
And life, actually.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Innocence.
Yeah. Innocence, absolutely.
Very big word. I just want people to know Josh is a graduate of the Art Institute of Chicago. Yeah. And I went to Columbia College and we were rivals. You know, we competed for parking places.
Right. Not football, but for parking.
Yeah.
Exactly. You're no stranger to putting like life experiences on stage. You did one, I'm 27, I still live at home and I sell office supplies. And that was at the Annoyance, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Okay.
That was a big show for me.
Yeah.
I'm trying to recapture that.
You're also, you know, 25 years, respected improv teacher, Second City, IO, the Annoyance, Victory Gardens, author, co-author of a book, Improvising Better, a guide to working improviser and author of Improv Therapy. You know, talk about why improv is such a big part of your life and really how improv can positively affect everything you do, even in business and relationships.
So when I was 18 years old, I graduated from New Trier High School. I was a 300-pound kid, and I had cheated my way through the best high school in the country. And I had nowhere to go. Like, I had no direction. And so I found this improv class. At the time, it was called Players Workshop at the Second City.
It's, which my friend Jeff Rogers now
yes,
runs.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, and
yeah.
So he's a great guy.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I've worked with him. Improv saved my life because all of a sudden there was like-minded people who had come from dysfunctional families. They were all dysfunctional, and I know that.
See, it's okay, Josh.
Yeah. Your dad's doing a good job.
He's doing the best he thinks he can.
Yeah. So it saved my life, and so everything that I had been punished in home for or at school, you know, because I was a smart aleck, I was now being rewarded in improv.
Mm,
and how it works for Josh, I hope you get that. Mm-hmm. Okay.
He, by the way, he did Second City. All my kids did Second City for years. I mean, you were probably the longest.
Yeah, between that and soccer during the falls.
It was Saturday mornings, always going to improv down in Second City in Old Town.
And it was the clowning classes. It was I did a couple like scripted things and I can't memorize lines. So that was a little trickier. But I think my best experience with improv is that in any kind of life situation or just conversations, like you said, whether it be like relationship wise or your work, I think the best thing that improv can do is nothing is this, yeah, you know, but, or there's this like stop in the road. Improv is all about like, yes, and there's always that second part where there's a continuation and you keep going and there isn't really like a stopping point or a halt. There's always like another direction. So
I think Josh, you learned a lot.
I think so. I like
you really
so.
Did.
Yeah.
And, but I think what you said is absolutely right because we are so programmed in the world to say no to people's ideas. So when I do corporations or I, you know, whoever I'm working with, people want to say no out of fear. And so if you get people, even if the idea you're not going to use it, as an exercise in life, in business, to say yes to people's ideas. You know, that's how you get great ideas. Great ideas come from 100 bad ideas. It doesn't come from trying to get that one perfect idea.
I think the thing that propelled us to sign you up is he had a teacher in Montessori school who we just saw recently that always would say time and place.
Uh-oh.
Time and place, because he has a great sense of humor. But then I realized the teacher was also saying that to me. Like, all right, Dave, time and place. And I thought to myself, all right, obviously my kids are getting that all from me. Maybe how do we hone that comedy into something useful? And I thought improv.
Wait a second. What did they mean by time and place? That just seems like shut up. Just shut up. That's a Montessori.
That's the kindest way of saying it.
Right. That's the Montessori way. We don't say shut up. We say time and place, which means shut up.
That's very true.
That's very, very true.
And the other thing in Montessori, you used real objects, right?
Correct.
Yeah, okay. Were you thrown off in improv when you had to like pretend and mime them?
That part wasn't as tricky because anything could be anything in your hand. Then you pass to the next person. It's like, yes, and this thing has handles and it also flies around. You can't ever catch it. But yeah, time and place is more about, you know, being a goofball and a class clown and then having to find the time and place to do that, not
to use it in a different
way. I think it was Montessori's way of cancel culture.
Okay.
No. We didn't tell your son he couldn't say that. We said time and place.
Yeah. I'm going to send this to Heather, this interview, so she can hear this herself.
Good, because my daughter's passed Montessori. So
He did Montessori through eighth grade.
Oh, okay. Well, Heather, I love you, Heather. I love what you guys are doing there. You've done a great job with Josh.
Yes, you have.
You know who needs time and place? It sounds like me.
It sounds like me, too, by the way. I was looking at your like film and TV credits, like The Playboy Club, Public Enemies with Johnny Depp, ER, Natural Born Killers, The Untouchables. Like, tell me about those experiences, favorite experiences on that list.
Oh my God. Well, the couple, Natural Born Killers was with Oliver Stone. It was my first movie, and we shot in Joliet, in the prison. In Joliet, yeah. With real prisoners.
Wow, at that time, yeah.
Yeah, and that was scary. Yeah. And then Natural Born Killers was interesting because Johnny Depp was, it's really interesting to watch people at that level, like a star, and he understood it, being a star. Like in the morning, there'd be people, it was in Crown Point, Indiana, and there'd be people lined up waiting for him to talk, you know, waiting to see him. And he would get out of his, you know, his SUV, and he would talk to people and stuff like that. And I remember, I was really impressed with that. And he was very nice. And actually, Michael Mann, who was the director, he was kind of a chaotic guy, and he was giving me a direction, and I'm like, I don't know what to do, you know, which is me usually on a set. And I just said, to Johnny, what should we do? And he took the time to do that.
That's cool. That's very cool. Well, you can see Jimmy's one person show, World's Greatest Dad, ? That's with a question mark, playing at the Laughing Academy in Glenview. Saturday, there are two shows. The 7 sold out, 9 o'clock tickets still available at the laughingacademy.com. And for more on Jimmy, visit jimmycorain.com as well. Jim, happy Father's Day to you.
Well, thanks. Happy Father's Day to you. And Josh, did you get something for your dad yet?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, good to know.
Okay.
Good to know.
Can I just say time and place?
Time and place. Time and place. All right. Thank you, pal. Appreciate it. All right. We'll preview the world's largest music festival, Summerfest, just over the border after the top stories from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom right here on 720 WGN. All right. Dave and Josh Plyer here on 720 WGN. Josh, appreciate you being in studio tonight.
Yeah, of course.
There's nothing that says summer more than the great music and great food and the great outdoors, and that is Summerfest, just north of Chicago and Milwaukee. It's the world's largest music festival. It'll be entertaining nearly a million people. Summerfest opens next week, goes for 3 weekends, 9 days. The big gig will run June 22nd to the 24th, June 29th to July 1st, and July 6th through the 8th. And to talk about it all is Scott Zeal. He's the Vice President of Entertainment for Summerfest. Scott, how are you, buddy?
We are good. How are you guys doing?
I'm doing all right.
Doing great.
You know, your buddy Bob has retired. I've been talking to him for 10 years. You've been around for almost 2 decades at Summerfest, but Bob's shoes are still big ones to fill, aren't they?
Every day I get out of bed and think about the legacy that Bob created for the festival, being here for 46 or 47 years.
Yeah.
And so, yes, it's a lot of responsibility. But as you mentioned, I've been working with Bob since like 1992 or 93 when we met each other. And he taught me all the important stuff on how to put together a great music lineup.
Yeah, I was going to say, tell folks exactly what you do, Scott, because it's one of the greatest jobs on the planet. It really is.
Well, I'm paid to listen to music and book bands, which that myself and the team of about 5 or 6 other people think are going to get people excited to come to Summerfest. And so, you know, Summerfest is a very, very unique music festival. This year we're celebrating the 55th anniversary. It was started by the mayor of Milwaukee back in the late 60s, and we are something for everyone. So you can come to Summerfest and you can see, you know, you get into the park and you can see a country band playing on one stage, a classic rock band playing on another, a hip hop artist playing on the other stage. There's really, our goal is to provide music, you know, something for everyone. So that's my job.
I love it. You know, and I know this was inspired by the mayor at the time going to Oktoberfest, and he just loved this festival idea. But it was in a bunch of locations, and then finally in the early 70s, it was a Nike missile site. Is that what was on the lakefront that you guys replaced?
Yeah, there's all sorts of kind of stories, and some of them probably are true and some of them aren't, but it was literally, we're right on 75 acres now of lakefront property in downtown Milwaukee. So yeah, it was a missile site. There was, the city used it for a whole bunch of stuff. So the once the main kind of location settled here on the lakefront, it's just been a really incredible evolution of you know, Milwaukee companies sponsoring the festival, helping us build up permanent stages, restaurants, bathrooms. You know, a lot of music festivals, all the amazing music festivals around the country are really a kind of a mix, but most of them are built in parks and on temporary sites. So it's very unique that you have a location that has all of kind of the permanent amenities that, that Summerfest has.
Man, I've been coming up there maybe since I was 17, 18 years old. So this is like a summer tradition for me to always come and, you know, pick and choose what bands I want to see, where I want to float around, if I want to go to the main amphitheater. It's just always so much fun. But let's talk about the big names that start next week.
Sure. Yeah, we're, you know, following that kind of same, you know, guideline for our free stages. We were fortunate enough in during the COVID, leading into COVID, we remodeled our amphitheater, our 23,000 seat amphitheater. American Family Insurance came in as the title sponsor for the amphitheater and the festival. So we did this incredible renovation. We reopened the amphitheater after 2 years of changing all of the and improving all of the backstage stuff for the bands, the dressing rooms, catering, all of that stuff. And then the next year, all of the forward-facing patron amenities, so all new restaurants and bars and more bathrooms and new seating. And the Foo Fighters were the first band to kick off the opening of the amphitheater. So going into this year, we're super excited about the mix that we have. So we kick off the festival with Eric Church, big country superstar. I was talking to them the other day, and I thought, this is really the first time we've had Eric perform at the festival. And then I was remiss, he had been here as an opening act earlier in his career, but this is the first time that Eric, since he's become really big, that he will be performing at the amphitheater. Our second day is Zach Brown Band, you know, one of our favorite artists. He's here every couple of years. Just a really great, country party. Just, he's an amazing entertainer. And then James Taylor and Sheryl Crow getting together for very special. I think when we booked it, it was the first one that they were going to do together this summer. I don't know if they've added any more dates, but they're friends. And so yeah. I think we'll see some kind of unique moments. And, That's just the first weekend.
Yeah, I love that it's now weekends. Yeah, I love that it's weekends like this, because you really did change how this works. And I think there was a lot of good things that came out of COVID, like how should we do this differently? And, you know, that's when you have most people off and available to go do things, is the weekend anyway. Weekdays, it's a little tougher to get out of work, a little tougher to stay up late and watch a concert. So I think the concept of doing this over three weekends is brilliant.
And that kind of follows a little bit of a trend too in the festival business, where, you know, you've seen like Coachella and Austin City Limits Festival. They by demand, they would sell out one Thursday, Friday, Saturday weekend, and then they decided to add a second weekend. So that was, you know, kind of part of it. But you're right. I like the fact that you can come here, you know, the first weekend, then you go home, you go back to work, you kind of catch up on sleep and refocus on the second weekend and the third weekend's lineups to kind of plot your next moves.
Well, and BMO Harris Pavilion too, that same first weekend, you got Cheap Trick, you got the Abbott Brothers, and then Elvis Costello. I love Elvis Costello. I mean, he's a legend all of in itself. And so, you know, these are just the two main stages for the most part. But I mean, there's obviously music throughout the whole park. Next weekend, you kick things off with the Dave Matthews Band.
So Dave, again, you know, incredible performer, been coming to the festival for quite some time. He released a new album this spring, so we'll hear some new music from him with all of the hits. And you know, then just to show kind of how different, you know, things are, or we are. That's on Thursday, June 29th. Then on Friday, June 30th, we're very excited to present Odessa, which is, if you don't know anything about Odessa, and there, it's a combination of, you know, kind of traditional DJ, EDM, you know, show, but they put so many cool live elements into the performance, the marching band, like other, you know, they're playing instruments, and it's you know, a light and visuals, you know, super, super over the top show. So that's something different for us. It caters to a different audience. That's on Friday. And then on Saturday, July 1st, I've got your favorite guy, a Boogie with a Hoodie.
It's Josh's. Now, it's so funny you say that, but we were talking in the car about this.
I mean, my musical taste kind of dances around. I did Lollapalooza for a number of years, and then I started doing Summerfest for a couple of weekends when I had the time to kind of travel up north for that. But no, there are definitely a bunch of people that I'm still waiting to see. A bunch definitely on your list for sure. I used to work for the Cubs for a few years, and with working baseball games, you also got to work concerts, which is also a huge plus. Sure. So that was really fun. But yeah, there's definitely a couple people on this list that I'd be interested in seeing this summer.
Yeah, the hip. We always do one big hip hop show. So yeah, it's a Boogie with a Hoodie, Trippie Redd, and City Girls. They're three of the biggest, you know, names in contemporary hip hop coming together for one night. So you know, just showing kind of the diversity. That's our second weekend.
Yeah, and then the BMO Harris at same week in Cypress Hill, Earth, Wind, and Fire. And that's what I love about this. You've got the classics, but you've got so many current and contemporary artists as well. It's just a great mix, so there is something for everyone, right?
Yeah, and I mean, when you talk about a band like Earth, Wind, and Fire, and you go see a show, you're going to have such a wide range of ages. I mean, that music is timeless. I mean, you know, people who are younger, like, they don't know it's Earth, Wind, and Fire, that are a couple of the songs that they know and love, or they've heard in TV shows or movies or whatever, but it's such a very, you know, positive way to get, like, a lot of different ages together.
Very cool. Well, we're talking to Scott Zeal, Vice President of Entertainment for Summerfest. We're going to give you all the details, how to get there, the cost-effective ways you can enjoy the music festival, and we'll do that next on 720 WGN. Dave Plyer, Josh Plyer on 720 WGN. We're talking to Scott Zeal, Vice President of Entertainment for Summerfest, which opens up in Milwaukee next week. So, you know, I was telling folks, like, this is an easy trip up to Milwaukee. And right now, with all the road construction we have going on our Kennedy Expressway, we have a NASCAR race coming down here. It's going to be easier to get to Milwaukee than to get to downtown Chicago. So this is the perfect time to get up there. But tell folks, like, what it costs, general admission, and some of the special ways that you can get in.
You know, one of the best things about Summerfest is it's literally one of the best values out there. So the most that anyone would pay to get into or to buy a ticket to walk into the Summerfest grounds is $26. It's less than that at certain times of the day. And every day we pride ourselves in admission promotion. So from noon until 3 or 4 o'clock every day, if you go to our website and click on the admission promotion, you can find, you know, a day where it's the Hunger Task Force. If you bring some canned food items or a book drive or, you know, all different things that can get you into the festival for free. So we're very proud of the fact that you can come here, and it's crazy to think, you know, we had mentioned Earth, Wind, and Fire a little bit ago, to be able to walk in and see them for, at the very most, $26, you know,
I know.
Close to $100 or more if you wanted to go see them in another venue.
Very, very true.
And that's just one. Yep, that's just one act. So, you know, the very cost-effective coming to Summerfest. You know, we have, there's some opportunities. I mean, clearly the Amtrak is probably the easiest way to, without driving, to get here, which puts you literally within walking distance to the festival grounds. There's some new information about our freeway flyer program. So there are park and rides on the south part of Milwaukee that you can drive to, park your car, and take a Milwaukee County Transit bus right to the front gate of the festival, and that same bus would return you back to the park and ride, so you can save part of the kind of the tricky parts. But it's there's a lot of ways to get here very quickly and very easily.
Well, and foods and drink, is of course a central component of all this. And I was looking at some of the new stuff, like I'll come for the cheese curds. There's certain things I know.
There are staple classics for sure.
Yeah.
But also some really interesting things I'm seeing here, like walking tacos, swine mac, which I can imagine what that looks like. But then you have things like, of course, like your Johnsville sausage sampler and the made for Instagram frozen chocolate covered cheesecake, among like other food and beverage items.
Yeah, it's really a cornucopia of choices from, both on the food and the beverage side. So, you mentioned Johnsonville, they're a new sponsor. So obviously we have our big music stages that you walk from stage to stage and see all the big names in music. And then we have some cool little spots, like Johnsonville has it's basically like a beer garden where, wide variety of all the good Johnsonville products, but some cool acoustic performers. There's a lot of things along the lakefront that are, craft beers being sold, so it's, we pride ourselves in we want you to be able to, enjoy some of the best food from, the area restaurants that are being sold on the grounds. But during the festival too, it's really a focus for families. We have the Gruber Law Office Sports Zone, which you can see sports demonstrations from all of the local professional teams and local teams. So it's we pride ourselves in a lot of different attractions to kind of complement the music stages as well.
Very cool. The world's largest music festival will be entertaining nearly a million people. Milwaukee Summerfest opens next week and goes for 3 weekends, 9 days. The big gig will run June 22nd to the 24th, June 29th to July 1st, and July 6th through the 8th. And for a complete list of all bands, food, deals, and more, you can visit summerfest.com. Scott, thank you again. I'll see you on the grounds sometime over the next couple of weeks.
Can't wait to kick the doors open next Thursday. Come on up, and you'll have a great time.
Thank you, Scott. All right, TV's Top Dads after the news next on 720 WGN. All right, with this being Father's Day weekend, we're going to take a moment to honor all the fabulous sitcom fathers who filled our TV screens with fumbling moments and fatherly wisdom. No matter the time or place, episode to episode, these father figures instilled in us endless life lessons. And joining us to talk about our favorite TV fathers is Wally Pedrazic, our resident television historian, author of the best-selling book, Watching TV, and a lecturer at the Department of Communication at University of Illinois Chicago. Welcome in, Wally. How you doing, pal?
I'm doing fine. Thank you for having me over to celebrate an important day.
Right?
Dad's Day.
Right. There was an evolution of fathers, and that's what I was thinking about. Everyone's got their favorite TV dads based on their favorite TV show, but there was an evolution of them over 60, 70 years on television. The earliest portrayals of dads were mostly simplistic and idealized, sticking to the script of what an ideal dad should be. The 70s and 80s gave way to a new family shows that mirrored shifting society. Suddenly blended families, dual income parents, work from home dads graced our screens. Fatherhood has been an evolving character on the small screen.
Yeah, and the very early ones sort of fit the society image of what was dad supposed to do. Well, dad was the one who was out earning the money. And so, yes, characters, Anita Bieber, Donna Reed Show, they would be the ones that you never really knew what they did, because they didn't spend a whole lot of time showing the dad at work. He did sometimes, but mainly it was to provide the means for the nice house and for the nice family to get into their silly complications. You had departures from that, but only gently. Someone like Ozzie and Harriet, probably the quintessential, what do they do in that household? Except getting into silly complications. But if you think about it, Ozzie was kind of a cool dad. They never really dealt with it, but he's a band leader. He played music. And so it was no surprise that son Ricky becomes a real-life MTV musical star, because that's what a cool dad does. A cool dad enables things for you as the child to move forward.
Yeah, so TV dads, you talk about that. So, you know, way back when, or the 40s, 50s, early 60s, were fathers we hoped for with the family lives we dreamed of. Like dad, as you said, worked a boring, but we didn't know what it was until maybe Rob Petrie, where you saw him go to work, was steady 9 to 5 while mom was at home to manage the kids in their little bubble. You know, you talk about iconic Jim Anderson from Father Knows Best. And I remember he was an insurance guy. I actually remember his job, right? He removed his jacket, rolled up his sleeves, you know, to solve the problems. Like, they were all waiting for dad to come home, you know, to ask those questions to get them through life that day, right?
Yeah, and you know, he was perfect in that role. And I used to joke when he did Marcus Welby.
Yeah.
It was sort of like Doctor Knows Best. It was sort of, you're still the father figure. You just happen to be the doctor that's counseling the patients. So those were dads as wise. But you mentioned Dick Van Dyke, and I think that's a good example of starting to cross over into somewhat more interesting dads. In that, I would love to have had, as a kid, Rob Petrie as my dad. Because he worked in showbiz, he was funny. And so when mom and dad got together and put on a little show in the living room, I mean, that was not just the dad we wanted to have, but it was the dad all of our friends would be jealous of.
Well, you talk about the show business part of this. You know, Desi Arnaz was a performer. Little Ricky was almost like a fixture on the show. He's almost like a piece of furniture. He wasn't really weaved into many of the storylines, but I guess there was moments that you saw him, and he was an interesting guy as a father. You know, what other 50s and 60s, let's talk about 1950s shows. You mentioned Donna Reed. You know, that was probably as white bread as you could get.
Yeah, and in that case, it's no accident that the name of this show is the Donna Reed Show. That is, the husband, the father figure, was important, was a support, but was always a support. I think that programmers in the 50s going into the 60s determined that what you wanted for comedy were the wacky redheads. You needed the silly people. And the dad was sort of just there to support. And that's why it was so welcome when you had someone like an Andy Griffith, for instance. He had a cool job. He was sheriff. But he was bringing a little bit more meat to the counselor, because you saw his everyday life and you saw his son integrated into the everyday life. You couldn't help it because it was a small town. And so what you did at work was not often some distant place. It was part and parcel of what life was like in your town. And that's what it really comes down to. You touched on this before, is that dads are reassuring, they're respectable, they're sometimes goofy, sometimes bland, but they're who you look to when things get serious. And so, you know, mom is the moral compass, but the dad is the solid foundation that the family would be built on.
I've got two 50s and 60s clips. Let's start with Father Knows Best. Back-to-back episodes, by the way, of Father Knows Best airs weekday mornings at 8 on Antenna TV. Let's take a listen.
Hi, Dad.
Hello, bud.
Say, can I talk to you alone? Just you and me?
Well, sure. Nothing wrong, is there?
No, but I just want to talk to you without Betty or Kathy butting in. Seems every time I try and say something, I get hit in the face with a petticoat.
Well, it's a tough life, son. But I'm with you.
Well, I was talking to Doug Hartley today at school.
Hi, honey.
Oh, hello, dear. How was your day?
Oh, the usual. Oh, Ruth Clark phoned. They're giving a dinner party tomorrow night. They'd like us to come.
Good. Tell them we'll be there.
Mommy, the frosting's boiling.
Oh, dear. Excuse me.
Oh, now, as you were saying.
Well, Doug Hartley, he's a guy at school, lives right down the block. He's got this car, and Dad, you ought to see it. It's absolutely in perfect shape. It's got everything on it. Wheels, fenders, headlights, everything. Brakes were just relined. The radiator's just like new. Barely leaks at all. And the tires are in real good shape. They still got tread on them. It's a sensational car, Dad, and Doug wants to sell it. He'll let me have it for just $10.
$10?
Sure, and he's going to throw in a spare front axle and a complete set of road maps of northern Canada. What do you think of the idea, Dad?
Well, I don't know, bud. Let's think about it.
But I've got to let him know. He's got five guys that want to buy it. I've got the money. I'm paying for it myself.
Well, it's not just the money, bud.
Well, then what's the problem, Dad? I've got my junior operator's license. I'm legal.
I know, but...
Dad, I want this car more than I've ever wanted anything in my whole life.
Sound advice from Robert Young. How about some advice from Leave It to Beaver?
You know, Dad, it's funny.
What's funny?
Well, whenever we cook inside, Mom always does the cooking. But whenever we cook outside, you always do it. How come?
Well, it's sort of traditional, I guess. You know, they say a woman's place is in the home, and I suppose as long as she's in the home, she might as well be in the kitchen.
Oh. Well, that explains about Mom, but how come you always do the outside cooking?
Well, I'll tell you, son. Women do all right when they have all the modern conveniences. But us men are better at this rugged type of outdoor cooking. Sort of a throwback to caveman days. Hand me those asbestos gloves, would you, Molly? Well, there's no sense in us cavemen burning our hands.
Yeah, that wouldn't fly today by any means. Andy Griffith was the first of his kind of a single dad on television, and I know there's a documentary that Ron Howard's daughter is doing this weekend on Apple Plus TV about dads in general. But I mean, you know, Andy Griffith and Ron Howard, he probably had two of the best TV dads, and that was Andy Taylor and Howard Cunningham.
Yeah, with Tom Bosley on Happy Days. And that's actually a wonderful bridge. You have a 70s series about a 50s settings, taking a 60s icon as the son. And there was, again, something reassuring about having a father figure, whether it be Sheriff Taylor or Howard Cunningham, saying, I'm gonna give it to you straight, and let's work on this together. And we're talking about ideal dads. These are not showbiz dads. These are dads who are there doing the day in, day out work of being a parent. And that's it's a partnership with the spouse, of course. But the being a parent is probably the highest calling you could have. And these dads for Ron Howard's characters were great showpieces in television viewing.
We're talking to Wally Podrazik, author of Watching TV, about TV's most famous fathers. And there's more when we come back on 720 WGN. Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. We're talking to Wally Podrazik, author of Watching TV, about TV's most famous fathers. So that was a clip from Mike Brady and the Brady Bunch giving some advice, as he always did. Let's talk about the 70s a little bit. You know, we talk about Mike Brady and the Brady Bunch. It was six kids, blended family, a dog, a maid living with them in the house. I mean, they were starting to show on television just some different scenarios.
Yeah, we're essentially... Now we're moving not just in having a father who's a pal, so to speak. But you have kids starting to live their further live their fantasy lives of independence with dad as sort of their co-conspirator, someone who will help them do what they want to do. It's not necessarily get around mom. It's their enablers. They're saying, look, we're in this together. Let's have some fun.
What about Archie Bunker? Good dad?
Archie Bunker was a great dad. Archie Bunker loved his little girl, Gloria, Sally Struthers. And you knew he was a great dad because he put up with Meathead.
That's right. That's right.
And the only reason that he did, initially at least, was because that's who his daughter had chosen to be her spouse.
What kind of a name is Stivic? Huh? Where you from?
Oh, Chicago.
I mean, what's your nationality?
I'm an American.
I mean, where are your people from?
They're from Poland.
That will make you Polish then, huh?
Yeah. Anything interesting in the paper?
Yeah, 200 arrested at Vietnam Day peace demonstration. 200. They should have thrown a whole bunch of them in the can. Look at that picture there. Here they are, throwing all kinds of junk and debris at officers of the law. Desecrating on the American flag. The hell are them peace things want anyhow?
Well, I think they just don't like the idea of America fighting an illegal and immoral war.
Well, if they don't like it, they can lump it. Take it down the road and dump it.
What are you saying America love it or leave it?
That's right. It's a free country, so am's great.
Well, that would include me too, Mr. Bunker.
Then toodly you to you too?
Well, what would our leaving solve? I mean, with or without protesters, this country would still have the same problems.
What problems?
Well, it's the war, the racial problem, the economic problem, the pollution problem.
Oh, come on, if you want a nitpick.
Nitpick? Let me tell you something, Mr. Bunker.
No, let me tell you something, Mr. Stivic. You are a meathead.
What did you call me?
A meathead. Dead from the neck up. Meathead.
Now I see what your idea of a free country is. You're free to say anything you want, but if anyone disagrees with you, they're either thrown into jail or called a meathead, right?
That's right, because this is American land that I love.
Well, I love it too, Mr. Bunker, and it's because I do that I protest when I think things are wrong.
Then stand beside her. And guide her.
The right to dissent is the principle upon which this country was based.
With the light from above.
Listen to me. It's in the Bill of Rights.
From the mountains.
Why do you think we broke away from England to begin with, huh? Because we didn't agree with her. We demanded freedom.
Would fall.
Gee, it's guys like you. It's guys like you who don't listen to reason. I mean, you're not listening to anything. You're too close-minded. You're prejudiced. You're prejudiced. Not anymore. I'm leaving.
Get away from me. My home, sweet home.
One of my favorite dads was on Veronica Mars, where you saw this father and daughter bonding. Enrico Bellantoni played Keith Mars. Kristen Bell played Veronica Mars. And some of the best moments were father-daughter moments, where they were making pizza or they were just trading the latest news on their individual days. And, of course, if you want to see both ends of the spectrum with the same actor as a dad, but in very different ways of protecting his family, that would be Bryan Cranston.
Sure.
Who's got Malcolm in the middle. As Hal Wilkerson, who's very, you know, kind of a milquetoast or sort of completely dominated by the spouse because there was no way that you couldn't be. And then you have same actor playing dad Walter White in Breaking Bad.
And the thing is, in both cases, you had absolutely looking out for family, just as James Gandolfini's Tony Soprano looked out for his family.
Yeah.
Walter White looked out for his family right to the very end of that series. That was the most important thing for him to do, is provide for his family.
We're talking to Wally Podrazik, author of Watching TV, about TV's most famous fathers. And there's more when we come back on 720 WGN. All right, it's Dave Player back with you here on 720 WGN. We're talking about America's favorite TV dads.
When we talk about the 80s, you know, there was America's dad was Bill Cosby. I know it's really hard to separate the man, the actor, from the character that was developed. But I mean, that show, I mean, was a fabulous show. I mean, there's just no question in anybody's mind, if you watch The Cosby Show, that you wouldn't rank Cliff Huxtable at the top of that list. But then as the 80s and 90s came, and even in the 2000s, I felt like there was a rise of kind of the dopey dad, like, you know, Homer Simpson, Al Bundy, Ray Romano of Everybody Loves Raymond, Ty Burrell from Modern Family. It was just time to make fun of dad. And Bob Newhart always told me that he hated that role. It's why he didn't want to become a father, really, on his shows, is he just didn't want to become the big, dumb, dopey dad.
Yeah, because that became, if the dad was going to be more than just the breadwinner, well, then he was the object of ridicule. And that may be why one of my favorite, further down the timeline, dads would be John Mahoney as Marty Crane in Frasier. Granted, he's a dad of two grown guys, grown sons. Sometimes you'd be hard-pressed to describe them as grown-up, but he was the type of dad that I would love to have there, dispensing wisdom, helping me through, and telling me straight. And he was no dummy. He was definitely the smartest, practical, street smarts guy in the room. And so you have dopey dads, and then you have Marty Crane.
Well, and then you had Jerry Stiller, Frank Costanza, you know, who was that, honestly, one of my favorite characters ever.
You just named Jerry Stiller, and you have, you could just picture the character of George Costanza going one-on-one with Frank Costanza. You know, it's not the best dad, but, you know, as long as you don't have to deal with him every day, it's the funniest dad to watch.
That's true.
And they have a family dinner on with the two of them one-on-one. I could see why Jerry and the rest would just sit there and just watch. Just watch.
Oh, yeah. And it absolutely was. I mean, the outtakes are even my favorite. You talk a little bit about animated dads, a little bit about Homer Simpson, but you also note Fred Flintstone. He was a dad who cared about his kids. Bob Belcher from Bob's Burgers, Peter Griffin from Family Guy. I mean, these are some, you know, I almost put them on the same wavelength as Jerry Stiller. They're a character within their own character.
Yeah, and that makes it sort of acceptable and even kind of harmless, because you can say it's only a cartoon. So he could do really silly stuff. But you know what? When Fred Flintstone became a dad, I mean, it didn't start out that way. The Flintstones started out with just Fred and Barney and Wilma and Betty. But then Wilma became pregnant, and suddenly he's a dad.
Yeah.
And that was quite a turn for an animated sitcom.
It was. No, it absolutely was. There's also, you know, out of the contemporary shows that are out there, I think one, you know, I loved Modern Family. I love that show. I think the dads in there were a lot of fun. Anthony Anderson plays on Black-ish, quite entertaining. And here's a clip. He's ticked off, and this is perfect for today. He's ticked off at being gypped on Father's Day, so he comes up with a new holiday that might better serve him and the rest of the dads across America. Let's take a listen.
This is going to be huge. We already have a list of potential sponsors that we're going to pitch. Coke owns Christmas. Hallmark owns Valentine's. Picture this. Bud Light presents Daddy's Day. We winning!
Dre, there is nothing wrong with old school Father's Day.
Yeah, maybe if you're an old school father who just came home, down to Scotch, beat his kids, and went to sleep.
I'm so tired of hearing you whine about that. Oh, and by the way, dummy, this is the dumbest idea of all the dumb ideas you've ever had.
See, this sweet kiss of sunshine is the dude that Father's Day was built for. Me? I'm different. I take my kids to soccer practice. I help my children with their homework. I wore a Bjorn, damn it!
Is that that little half bra with the baby hanging out the front? You know, you really ought to stop mentioning that, son.
Ooh, a family meeting. I'll be in my room. Come on, Rashida.
Hey, where are you going?
To my room. I just said that.
Perfect example. Had you spoken to old school father that way, he would have knocked all your teeth out.
Wisdom teeth included.
See?
You know what? I'm gonna call myself an Uber because it looks like you're about to get a whoop.
Okay, look. I'll make it quick, all right? There's a new holiday, Daddy's Day, sweeping the nation, spearheaded by your main man, Trickity.
Okay, you girls should go.
All right, family. You have till Sunday.
No.
Come on.
And there you have it. So you've got he's creating Daddy's Day or whatever it might be in the fall during football season when he can really enjoy it. You know, feeling that Father's Day is too close to Mother's Day and everyone's spent all their energy on Mother's Day already. He wants to be celebrated. And that's what I love. Wally Pedraza, pick up the latest edition of best-selling book, Watching TV. It is the comprehensive history of television and all your favorite TV shows as well. Wally, always a pleasure getting your insight on all this.
Thank you so much. Have a happy Father's Day.
Thank you, sir. Very much. Appreciate it. All right, a little history coming up next on 720 WGN.
Dave Pryor, WGN.
Chicago, Chicago, that toddling town. Chicago, Chicago, I'll show you around. I love it, bet your bottom dollar you lose the blues in Chicago. Chicago, the town that Billy Sunday could not shut down.
Chicago's thrived for almost 200 years, growing from backwoods swamp to a rail and manufacturing hub to a light of the new millennium. And while so many great structures have been lost or demolished, much of this history still lives on. Within the pages of this new edition of the book Oldest Chicago, you'll get to know the history of the Windy City's most iconic buildings and the stories that bring their walls to life. Now, author David Anthony Witter has been documenting Chicago's history and neighborhoods for over 30 years. His books include Oldest Chicago, Chicago Magic, History of Stagecraft and Spectacle, and his historical articles and photographs have appeared in the Chicago Reader, the Tribune, Living Blues, and other publications. Now, David has also added his feel and appreciation for Chicago's history and culture through playing the blues at local venues. And David joins us tonight. Welcome in, David.
Hey, nice to talk to you. Nice to get to meet you, Dave.
I really did enjoy this book. I am a Chicagophile true and true, and you obviously have a long-time passion for our city's history.
Yeah, well, like I said, I grew up here. I went to Alcott School, which is two blocks, what is it, east of Kingston Mines. The new Kingston Mines, actually the old Kingston Mines, is on Lincoln and Belden. And I went to Lane Tech, and I went to college here. So, you know, it's a great city, and it's got great history and great people, and I'm proud to be a part of it.
When did you first come up with the idea for the book? I mean, you can love Chicago. You can love it all day long. You know, when did you start saying, you know, I got to put this to paper, and I got to make sure I share this with everybody?
Yeah, it happened. I was writing for New City magazine, and the Berghoff was closing. That was around 2005 or 6. Mm-hmm. It reopened, but and every day there were long lines, and all the Berghoff is closing. So I wrote an article saying, "Well, here's your alternatives. Here's, you know, Berghoff is closing, so here are the other oldest places. Here you can go to the, you know, this bar here, Green Mill, and Schaller's Pump, and so on. Schaller's Pump is now gone, but." And I got such a response. In those days, it was letters. Today, it would be emails. And then I said, you know, why not just keep going? And I did, I think, four or five bars and restaurants that were, you know, contemporaries of the Berghoff. And I said, why not expand it to drugstore, cafeteria, hot dog stand, museum, yeah, house, graveyard? And it sort of worked out.
But before we dive into some of the places you highlighted with great details and vintage photos, I'm going to ask you right off the bat, like, what classic building in Chicago is most fascinating to you? That just that when you did the research and you put this book together, you said, wow, that is the highlight, that is the crown jewel of my book.
Well, it's probably in the Fisher Building, and that's in the South Loop. And the cool thing about that is it's got all the facade has got all it's the Fisher Building, and there's sort of a joke, and the facade has all these different sea creatures sort of embedded in the kind of instead of gargoyles, they have all these sea creatures embedded in the facade and in sort of around the building. And so, you know, when I worked in downtown, I would just try to find sea creatures that were embedded in the Fisher Building. And, of course, the Monadnock, all those buildings from the, you know, the post-Chicago Fire 1890s, you know, basically it was the architectural revolution of its time. You know, the auditorium, you know, theaters was right there. Those were all the same era, and they really, we were cutting edge, you know, a century ago, we were the cutting edge city, you know.
Absolutely. You break this whole book down by area and then by oldest church, bar, statue, school, funeral home, brewery, bowling alley. The list is endless. And by the way, if you have a question for David Witter, 312-981-7200, you're welcome to join us for the conversation. Let's highlight a few and share some of that history. Oldest Drive-In, I want to highlight that right away because I was there today. Because I really took a look at the second look at your book yesterday, but I went to Superdog and took my boys there today. That's obviously one of the most legendary places of Chicago.
Isn't it a wonderful place? Yeah, yeah. I live close to there too. There's actually a tie-in between Kingston Mines and Superdog because Jim Jacobs, the author of Grease, grew up around there, and he used Superdog as somewhat of a model, and then the play premiered at Kingston Mines. But that happens when you read too much about Chicago history of all these useless facts. But
not useless Superdog at all. I love this.
Superdog is just a great place, and it is a drive-in. And the Maury and Flory, the two fiberglass hot dogs on top,
yep.
And
named after the founders. Owners. Yep.
Yeah, he's passed away about 3 or 4 years ago, yeah. Maybe five. But the family still runs it, and it's packed, you know, all the time. And it's one place that, fortunately, because of its drive-in, drive-through type setup, it's doing even better lately.
You know, I was when I was there today, I was talking to one of the waitresses, and she said, you know, we sell some of the old menus, like some of the old lit boards, but you know, I'm sure they're not cheap. I mean, they're part of history, and there's so few of them, but they're like $500. Like if you want to buy one of the originals that's been used in the lot, so I'm a geek for that stuff, but that's a little hefty price for me right now.
Yeah.
Church, oldest church, and these are a lot of things too. Like I always thought I knew what some of the oldest places are around Chicago. And the First United Methodist Church, 1831, that's one of the oldest, you know, places anywhere in Chicago.
Yeah, that's 77 West Washington. I kind of broke it down between the church and the church building. The oldest church building is Old St. Pat's.
Right.
And these are these little technicalities you get into it. But a church is actually a group of worshipers, you know. So the First United Methodist Church, it actually was started when these people called the Reverend Jesse Walker, they were called the Methodist Circuit Riders. And Chicago was founded, you know, on Wolf Point right there at where the merchandise mart is, basically. And these guys came around because we had a lot of rough and tumble guys there, trappers or fighting and drinking. And so these church people came around in around 1831 and tried to reform it. It didn't work because the trappers did not want to have anything to do with religion, but there were some women and children and families that did. So what they did is they eventually floated. The church was on a log cabin, and they floated it across the river from Wolf Point, I guess, south would be southeast to kind of where it is now. And then it was a log cabin church for a while, and then they built another building. The structure now, I think, was built right before World War I, if I'm not mistaken.
Very cool. Well, we're talking to David Witter. He's the author of Oldest Chicago. Really fascinating book. And there's more with David after this on 720 WGN. All right, it's Dave Plyer back with you here on 720 WGN. We're talking to David Witter. He's the author of the terrific book about our city's history, and that's called Oldest Chicago. There was a couple surprises in here. You know, Anderson's books, which I had no idea was that old, that's still run by the same family since 1875. Is that correct?
That's in Naperville, and that's at the end of the book where I kind of do the excerpts. But that's in the, that started out in 1875. It's more or less of a drugstore. But I even remember as a kid growing up in Chicago that drugstores sold books, and they sold magazines and books and certainly comic books, and that was not that long ago. So I could see Naperville as a farm town in the 1870s, where it was kind of a general store where they sold everything, and eventually they just kept selling books, and they decided just to make it a bookstore.
Very cool. Yeah, very cool. And there's another family one that's in here, the Yeager Funeral Home, that began in 1858.
Yeah, that's Cicero and Addison, and that is just it's an old German family, and they talked about how the guy would ride around in a one of their grandfathers or one of the relatives was about 6'4" or 6'5". And he'd have this black, in those days the horses were horse drawn wagons.
Right.
So, he'd be on top of this horse drawn wagon with this guy in his black suit with a black cape and a big black top hat driving down the street. You know, it must have been a pretty scary.
Yeah, is it creepy? But, I was just going to say, Wow. Looking at some of the other things in the book, and again, there's just scads of categories here, there's common ones like, the old water tower, talking a little bit about that on Michigan Avenue. But the Italian Village restaurant, again, I knew it was older, maybe 1940s. 1927 is when that first opened.
Yeah, and that's another family business, been in the same family since it started. A lot of these restaurants, the owners does everything in the beginning, and he cooked. And one of the interesting stories is it opened in 27, and they were doing well. Then obviously the Depression came, and apparently he started growing vegetables on the roof and all around wherever he could find, grass and free space downtown the roof and on the sides. And so they grew their herbs there, and it just sort of started, And that's one of the things that got them through the Depression. It's another place, there's no operas going on or, things that usually drew people downtown. So that's another place that's probably like the Berghoff. And these places aren't they're not drive-throughs. So you're not going to do a carry-out at the Berghoff. But there's either places that we hope stick around,
Absolutely. No question. Oldest hardware store. 1924, this is something that all over the city of Chicago and even into the suburbs too, some of these old mom and pops. I remember going to an old hardware store when I first bought my house, and it was set up very differently. I walked in, it's gone now, but you walked into a counter and there was nothing I could shop for myself, and he'd say, "What are you trying to do?" And I tell him what I was doing, and then he'd give me all the parts and pieces, and with a little piece of paper, and drew out exactly what I needed to do. And that was kind of the old-fashioned way of doing it. But the oldest hardware store in Chicago is Clark and Devon Hardware, which I think I knew. That's a classic.
Right. They've got a very cool clock. It's worth buying the book just to see the picture of the clock.
Yeah,
the clock,
it's beautiful.
Is kind of like wrenches. They're like socket wrenches that go around. But that's the Walchick family, and a lot of this. There's kind of every good story has to have a plot and a conflict. And what I've been talking about is how these places have survived. And Clark Devon survives in the era of the big box stores just by providing complete and excellent service. They'll fix anything, they'll sharpen anything, they'll do windows, they'll do screens, and there's a lot of apartment buildings in Rogers Park, multi-unit apartment buildings, and so the super, as they call them in New York, they need something fixed, and they need it now, and Clark Devon will do that. Rather than the big box stores where people go, "Well, I think I want a remodel, I want a new door," Clark Devon is like, "Look, there's a clog pipes in this unit and it's flooding the building and I need a router right now," and they give it to him.
Yeah, amazing. That's the old school way of doing business, isn't it?
Yeah,
absolutely.
They have like 20 different desks there for different things, the rental and listings and this and fixing that. It's all these little compartments.
Yeah, it's fun to go to. Absolute destination. Oldest tobacco shop, which I must check out because I'm a cigar guy. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, you haven't been to Iwan Reese. That's the oldest family business. That's, I think, 1856. States. I think Charles Dickens went there.
Wow.
Yeah, and it makes sense because Charles Dickens was a pipe or cigar. I think he had his own cigar brand for a while. So yeah, that's been in the same family more or less too. Mr. Hoffman is the person I talk to, and you know, I'm sure. I think it's his grandfather or great-grandfather or uncle. You know, sometimes it's not a direct ascending line, but it's basically the same family. And, you know, I'm sure they're doing okay now because a lot of their stuff is mail order, you know, with tobacco.
Sure.
But they have a real nice smoking room, and that's definitely a link to the past, you know, the cigar room.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've even identified, and this is the favorite one that you have here, is you've got Chicago's oldest tamale shop, the Tom Toms, right?
Yeah. The Chicago tamale is an interesting story. It's quite different from what we think of as a tamale. You know, the traditional, I guess you call Mexican tamale, is masa, with the chunks of meat wrapped in a corn stalk sometimes. And the Chicago tamale is actually more like, they're almost like big yellow cigarettes or cigars.
And it's
cornmeal mush, and then it's a ground meat, and they sort of pack them real tight. And it's the Chicago tamale.
The best.
They don't have it anywhere else.
Absolutely.
And you get them at hot dog stands and things like that, you know, and it's definitely a Chicago original.
Absolutely. You also explore the oldest bar in Illinois. You go through a little bit in some of the suburbs. Long Grove is the oldest bar. And you know, they've got it there. It's pretty old school. I've been there countless times. Friday night fish fry, and downtown Long Grove has always, you know, it's always been a family favorite. But that bar's been there forever.
Forever, yeah. 1847. That's outlived even me. Yeah. And probably me and you combined, and we're not young men. It's one of the oldest. It's kind of one of the oldest bars in the country. Now there are a lot of older ones east and Lafitte's in New Orleans, but it was a very German town, and basically it was a stop between Chicago and Wisconsin, where people would. Basically like a gas station except for horses, and you'd get your horse water and hay, and they thought, well, maybe we can give these guys a drink and something to eat while they're getting their horses shod and so forth. And
that's
kind of how that started. Yeah,
I love it. Well, we've only touched about a handful of places featured in this fascinating new book. It's called Oldest Chicago. It's a second edition. It's available, of course, on Amazon and at your local bookseller. David, thank you. It's always it's a fascinating book. I just loved every bit of it, and it's been a lot of fun chatting with you tonight.
Okay, thank you. Great to have you on, and great to keep listening to WGN. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, buddy.